Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select Eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
Tomorrow, the second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump begins in the Senate. 1 month after the attack where the insurrectionist mob invaded that very chamber. House Manager Jamie Raskin read the charges against Trump.
In his conduct while President of the United States and in violation of his constitutional oath faithfully to execute the office of the President of the United States and to the best of his ability preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States and in violation of his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, Donald John Trump engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors by inciting violence against the government of the United States.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Today, we're going to talk about the historic second impeachment of Donald Trump, only the fourth impeachment trial in U.S. history, and the first of a president now out of office. What's at stake for the country? Well, let's start today with Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
So where does your mind travel to when thinking about what is at stake in this historic second impeachment trial?
Well, I think the House managers may go wrong if they argue that if the senators do not convict Mr. Trump, they would have failed to hold him, quote, accountable. I think the accountability moment came with the second impeachment. As you have said, that's unique. It is a unique and condign stigma in American history. Trump has now reached a threshold no other president of disgrace that no other president has, and that will last. He is accountable. That made him accountable before history. And already, of course, historians are saying, in 2018, a poll of American political scientists who studied the presidency rated him the worst president. Siena College, in a poll, had him in the bottom five. This was 3 years ago. Now there's no question that he is in his own sub-basement and probably sinking down even beneath the level of presidents into people like Joe McCarthy and Aaron Burr. So he is tarnished by this, tarnished irreparably, lastingly.
You know, I think it says something about the state of the country or the fractured nature of our politics that there are, first of all, like it is, as you said, Jack, it's factually true that there have been only four impeachments and impeachment trials of presidents in all of the U.S. history. Donald Trump has two of them, 50% of them. That, to your point, puts him amongst a camp of no others. And at the same time, though, I mean, I wonder what you think about the fact that there are many who hear that and say, well, those impeachments weren't done for the good of the country. They were simply partisan acts, right? They don't even think that the impeachments should have happened. So, you know, how much accountability do we really have here?
Well, polls show that only 13% last week, a Monmouth poll, only 13% of Republicans believe he should be impeached. But there is a majority in the country favoring his conviction. Of course, impeachments are necessarily partisan simply because the threshold of 67 votes is just too much for any president, for any impeachment conviction to be met. But I think all of this partisan, nonpartisan, all of that is going to fade. And as the generation that Trump has mesmerized, the people whose credulity he has exploited, as they pass from the scene, their children and grandchildren are going to read of a kind of villain in American history. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. So when the tumult and the shouting is over, he's going to stand there with this unique and, as I say, condign stigma.
Mm. And so just to be clear, though, Jack, you said earlier that I want to be sure I heard you correctly, that who may be amiss in trying to push for a conviction here?
Well, no, I'm just saying that the Democrats would go wrong in saying that we fail to hold him accountable unless you senators convict him. No, he's already been held accountable.
I see. Okay. So actually, I'm curious about what On Point listeners think about that. So send us a tweet or hop on Facebook at onpointradio.org. Oh, sorry, that's our website. We're at On Point Radio on Twitter or Facebook. And let us know what you think. Does accountability in this case of former President Trump rest on a conviction in the trial that begins tomorrow, or as Jack says, is the very fact of the second impeachment enough? That is a really interesting framework here to think about the rest of the hour. So, Jack, hang on here for just a moment because I want to bring in Lisa Desjardins. She's with the PBS NewsHour, joins us from Washington. Lisa, it's great to have you back on the show.
So good to be here.
I wonder if I'd like to actually get some real nuts and bolts from you about what's going on in the Senate, what people are thinking right now. So what was the mood amongst senators over the weekend as they looked forward to the beginning of the trial on Tuesday?
I think you see three different camps in the Senate, those Republicans especially, Trump supporters especially, who say this will be rejected out of hand and are focusing on the idea that they don't think this is constitutional, which I know you've talked about and you'll talk about more. It's a fascinating major debate. Then you see Democrats who say this is absolutely constitutional, and we also believe that it is necessary for the democracy to take this step. Then there's the third group. They're the pragmatic group. Most of them say they are open to considering arguments on both of these questions, whether it's constitutional, whether the president should be convicted on the merits. But that group also acknowledges what I think is a fact at this point, which is that the votes are not there to convict President Trump. Now, it is, of course, possible that something happens in the trial to change that. But it is an uphill climb for the Democratic prosecutors.
Mm. And how is this trial going to be handled? Technically, of course, the senators themselves are the jury, but there's always that jury of public opinion, right? The court of public opinion. Are the House managers really trying to speak to the American people in how they're going to lay out their case as much as speaking to the senators?
You know, if you read the 80-page document brief that the House managers put out, it does seem like it is speaking to the American people as well as to U.S. senators. But what's interesting here is that the House Democrats seem to be, in a way, have a different goal than Senate Democrats. Senate Democrats right now want to have this trial, but they also want to keep it short because they are focused on trying to get through nominees especially and a coronavirus relief package from President Biden. So you're juggling these two things. Democrats who say we need to focus on what President Trump did. We need to convict him. And Democrats who say we don't disagree, but let's be honest, we don't think he will be convicted and we need to quickly move on to other business. And those two things don't exactly mesh. And that's why we have a fascinating day today. We are waiting for the two leaders of the Senate, the Democratic Majority Leader, Senator Schumer, and the Republican Leader, Mitch McConnell, to announce how this trial will work. It starts tomorrow, and we still don't know how long the arguments will go, how many days they will go, how long senators will have for questioning. Very basic contours of the trial still have not been announced.
Well, Lisa, there goes my next question to you, because I was going to say, what do we know about how the trial is going to run? But Jack, let me turn back to you for a second, because Lisa points out something which I have thought both for this impeachment and the previous one of former President Trump is one of the most discordant aspects of presidential impeachments that we've seen. And that is the sort of foregone conclusion, the presumption of a foregone conclusion, and also the practical need demonstrated by, in this case, Democrats to move as quickly as possible because there are other major aspects of legislation that are pending that they don't want to be totally overshadowed by the impeachment. Now, the reason why I find that discordant is those same Democrats are arguing that the former president of the United States damaged American democracy or threatened to damage American democracy or put American democracy in peril. So it's a major charge. I don't understand what the rush is if you're saying Donald Trump imperiled American democracy and yet at the same time we have to get through this trial quickly.
Yes, it's the stakes couldn't be higher morally and before history, and yet senators are politicians. They want to be reelected. They want their president, Biden, to be successful. They know that he has this window, not a honeymoon, but at least a window of public approval for his stimulus bill and perhaps more, and they want to take advantage of that moment. So I think they're torn between let justice be done, though the heavens fall, and no, keep the heavens up there, because we can't let this go on beyond a few days.
Mm. Well, Lisa, we have a tweet here from On Point listener who says, it's about whether the GOP will denounce and convict the former president. That's the story for the future, no matter if he's already been discredited by being impeached twice. Now, we already know, per your point, Lisa, what at least 45 Republican senators think based on that earlier vote about the constitutionality of the impeachment. I'm curious, do we know more about where Mitch McConnell himself, what he's thinking right now?
That is such a great question. We don't know. We know that, and I know from my own reporting, others have reported, that he was and remains furious with President Trump for a few reasons, but over the events of January 6th. And we've seen some of his sharpest statements ever against a fellow Republican, much less about a president, from Mitch McConnell on this topic. We know that he believes the president does have responsibility for what happened on January 6th. Now, what we don't know is if he thinks that rises to the level of convicting him of inciting the riot. McConnell has said that he is open and that he will consider the arguments. That's a statement everybody always says. You don't really, usually it doesn't mean that they really will consider them, but it could in this case. And I think he'll be fascinating to watch.
Interesting. So he's furious with former President Trump. And at the same time, for most of November and early December, he didn't necessarily do anything to push back against the big lie that Trump was fulminating about voter fraud. So Lisa Desjardins and Jack Beatty, stand by. We're trying to understand what's at stake with the historic second impeachment trial of Donald Trump, which is set to begin tomorrow. We'll take a look at the constitutional arguments when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are thinking through what's at stake with tomorrow's historic second impeachment of former President Donald Trump, the Senate trial scheduled to begin tomorrow. I'm joined today by Jack Beatty. He's On Point's news analyst. Lisa Desjardins joins us as well. She's with PBS NewsHour. She's with us from Washington. There has been a question about whether or not witnesses will be called for the impeachment trial of former President Trump. Interestingly, some of those witnesses were the senators themselves who had to clear the Capitol on the day of the insurrection on January 6th. But here's Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer speaking with Rachel Maddow on January 25th about the need for witnesses.
I don't think there's a need for a whole lot of witnesses. We were all the witnesses. You know, it's different than the previous trial. And we will not let the Republicans be dilatory just to delay it for its own sake so we don't do COVID or don't do anything, but it'll be fair.
Senator Schumer there on MSNBC. And here's Senator Lindsey Graham on Fox last week, actually agreeing with Schumer, but for different reasons, saying there shouldn't be any witnesses.
If the House managers want to use this as a political commercial against Donald Trump and Republicans, and they want to call witnesses now, they didn't call during the impeachment process in the House, this thing could go for weeks or months, and that would be bad for the country. So, to my Democratic colleagues, if you vote to call one witness, none were called in the House, get ready for a long trial.
Lisa, before we get deeper into sort of constitutional questions here, this issue of witnesses, has that been resolved? Will any be called?
It has not been resolved. We do not know. We know the template from the last trial was that the Senate would vote on whether it wanted witnesses or not. But to Senator Graham's point, if the Senate does decide to have witnesses and the House decides to call them or the president's team decides to call them, it does open up the door for a much longer process. Take the trial of former President Clinton. The way they handled witnesses in that case was to have outside depositions away from the Senate chamber and then play some video clips. So there are many, many different permutations of what a witness could look like. And of course, there are hundreds of witnesses that could be called, as you say, including the senators themselves. But that question has not been resolved yet.
Okay. So the former president has been charged with inciting violence against the government of the United States. That's essentially the single charge against him in this trial, which is set to begin tomorrow. And there's a lot of questions about that. So let me bring Kate Shaw into the conversation. She is a professor of law at Cardozo School of Law, a Supreme Court contributor for ABC News and co-host of the Strict Scrutiny podcast. Professor Shaw, welcome back.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
And for folks who are keeping track of these things, it was just, 3 weeks ago that we had you on, Professor Shaw, to talk about accountability in the immediate wake of that insurrectionist attack. So first of all, I actually want to start with a very big picture question here. Impeachments are charges where the president is said to have engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors. That's the language. What does high crimes and misdemeanors mean?
Well, you know, the full constitutional language is treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. But of course, the central words here are high crimes and misdemeanors. And I think that those are best understood to basically require political crimes, right? So crimes against the polity or democracy itself. Right. There are arguments that periodically surface that high crimes and misdemeanors basically just mean crimes, right? Really serious crimes, the kind of crimes that you would find, you know, a federal criminal statute prohibiting. But there's very little support for that argument. It actually was an argument that President Trump's team made when he was first impeached just over a year ago. And it has been made historically during other impeachment proceedings. But as a general matter, it's pretty clear that impeachment, high crimes and misdemeanors don't require, you know, the kind of evidence that would necessarily support a specific criminal charge, but are the kinds of offenses committed by public officials, that often entail abuse of office or authority or corruption, and that sort of definitionally can only be committed by individuals in public office. And so you may not find a specific criminal statute prohibiting them. And that's because the constitutional remedy for high crimes and misdemeanors is this process, right? Impeachment. So that's, I think, how the terms are best understood.
Isn't it? I think it's Alexander Hamilton. I mean, Jack mentioned Aaron Burr a little earlier, so I'm going to get Hamilton in here, but didn't Hamilton essentially write that high crimes and misdemeanors are abuses or violation of some public trust? So to your point about like it's an abuse of or violation of against the public, against democracy.
Right. Against the public, against democracy, and that, Hamilton also wrote, can peculiarly be committed by public men. So again, you know, you and I can't commit high crimes and misdemeanors. They can only be committed by individuals who hold public office and who offend against the public.
So it's a very particular kind of quote unquote crime, right?
I mean,
it can be it's only uniquely able to be done by someone who the entire nation has given their trust to. That's a really key thing here. Jack, did you want to comment on that?
Well, on that, in the Nixon impeachment in the House Judiciary Committee, the House did not include an article of impeachment based on tax fraud. Nixon had fiddled his taxes, and their rationale was that private misconduct was not worth impeachment. In other words, that's a crime. But it's not worth impeachment. It's a sort of civilian crime. It isn't a high crime. So that's an example, it seems to me, of this unique notion of a high crime, what it is and how it's distinct from, say, ordinary larceny.
Mm. Professor Shaw, your response?
No, I agree with that. And I think that, you know, we should say it's also the case that impeachment, you know, is committed by public officials, but not, you know, or is reserved for public officials, but not just, you know, the most senior public official, right? So not just presidents, but other public officials can be subject to impeachment. And so we have in our history impeached a cabinet secretary and a number of federal judges. And some of the charges involved in those impeachment proceedings, you know, were criminal offenses, bribery, things of that nature. But in many of those impeachment charges, whatever the ultimate result, right, some were convicted and some were acquitted. Many of them did not track a particular kind of criminal offense, but again, were about sort of public abuse, misconduct, offenses against the polity.
Okay, so, but as we know, the former President Trump's lawyers are laying out an argument where they just reject the constitutionality of the charge to begin with. They're just saying it's unconstitutional to have this trial. What's your analysis of that?
You know, I'd say that just as there have been arguments historically that impeachment must be for a specific enumerated crime, it is possible to make, and yet the weight of the evidence, I think, is very strongly against that. I think here, too, it is possible to make an argument that impeachment, or at least trials, can only be held for sitting federal officials. But I'm not aware of anybody who's studied the issue in depth who has reached that conclusion. I think it's pretty clear, you know, from a number of different perspectives, that it has to be possible to hold a trial of a former official, in particular if the impeachment itself happened while the individual was in office. Of course, President Trump was a President Trump when he was impeached by the House. He's just former president now. And I think there are, you know, a few kind of key reasons that has to be the case. One is, when it comes to impeachment, the law of impeachment is really the law made by Congress, right? The courts don't really weigh in on impeachment. They have said it is basically for Congress to decide how impeachments occur, sort of what the rules of proceeding are when we're talking about impeachment. So again, all we have is the law that Congress has made, and Congress has held impeachment trials for former officials previously. It has considered the question of whether it has the jurisdiction to hold those trials, and it has answered the question in the affirmative. So that, I think, is really important. It's also important, I think, that, you know, impeachment is the most serious constitutional remedy. It is the constitutional remedy for the most serious kinds of misconduct, right? High crimes and misdemeanors, as we were just talking about. And it just can't be the case that official misconduct that happens late enough in a term can escape this constitutional sanction. So just as a practical matter, it seems a very difficult argument to make. And I mean, I would say the last thing is, if you look at the drafting of the Constitution, the framers of the Constitution were aware that in England, impeachments and trials had happened of former officials. There was, in fact, an ongoing impeachment trial of a former official. He had left his position 2 years earlier. It was ongoing at the time the Constitution was drafted. They talked about this proceeding at the Constitutional Convention. So they were very aware of and, you know, familiar with and comfortable with these late impeachments. And so for all these reasons, I just don't think the argument that this is impermissible has a lot of real support at all.
Well, Lisa Desjardins, though, of course, as we know, that is part of the argument that Donald Trump's lawyers are making today in a pretrial brief, right? So first of all, let me ask you, Bruce Castor and David Schoen, I think that Donald Trump's gone through several legal teams before landing with these two. Can you tell us a little bit about them and how they ended up being the lawyers for the former president?
You know, I think we're still waiting to find out exactly how everyone came together. Mm-hmm. But these are two men that have some previous connections, and it's particularly David Schoen, connected through Roger Stone, the close ally of President Trump, who was on his pardon list in the late kind of days of his presidency. These are two men who have long litigation practices. And in some cases, Bruce Castor, he was a prosecutor in Pennsylvania, now as a private attorney there. But among the things that people highlight about him is, as a prosecutor, he did refuse to prosecute a case against Bill Cosby for sexual assault, saying that he didn't think that case was winnable. There was, of course, a separate case against Bill Cosby that later did produce a conviction against him on the same charge. Those were separate cases, but it was the same charge, obviously. Now, what's interesting about these two lawyers to me, what stands out among many things about them, they're both very colorful figures. They're both very strong characters. And in addition, they're coming into this late. They were not the attorneys who were thought to be representing President Trump as of just 2 weeks ago. And the previous weekend to this one, something changed. The president changed his attorneys. And now we have these two with just 2 weeks, essentially, that they had to get ready for a historic trial.
Yeah, you know, what's particularly interesting about Schoen is apparently he's got a track record in cases on public interest and civil rights in the South. And the former president of the Southern Poverty Law Center, Richard Cohen, is quoted in the New York Times as saying that, well, even though Cohen thinks that Trump deserves to be convicted, he says that Schoen, the lawyer, is, quote, a good lawyer and a good person who's attracted complex and challenging cases and not afraid to take on sometimes unpopular clients. So interesting there. I want to just stick for one more second with this question of whether or not the Senate even has jurisdiction to hold an impeachment trial after a president is out of office. Because we spoke with Keith Whittington, professor of politics at Princeton University. He's also a member of the Federalist Society and an expert in the originalist approach to the Constitution. Democratic House managers cited Whittington in their trial brief that they submitted last week because he says the founding fathers would have anticipated the possibility of impeachment after removal from office. Kate Shaw, you actually mentioned this a little earlier because that was common practice in the British Parliament.
For them, that was a familiar practice. It was consistent with what Parliament did. They didn't borrow everything that Parliament did. There are things that Parliament did that they specifically left out of the American constitutional system. But it's also true that states had adopted this same practice of being able to hold impeachment trials of former officers. Some state constitutions specifically allowed it explicitly in the text. And officers had gone through that experience in the American context as well before the founders drafted the federal constitution in 1787. So for them, this was sort of the background of what the impeachment power included. It included the ability of a legislature to call a former official to account for their official misconduct.
And Whittington also says that the Constitution specifically says the Senate can try all, underscore that word, all impeachments, no expiration date.
The constitutional text specifies that the House has a power of impeachment. It doesn't detail what exactly the power of impeachment includes, which is one reason why we have to look at prior practice in order to figure out what does this mean exactly to give the House a power of impeachment. But the Senate is specifically empowered by the constitutional text to try all impeachments. And if you can try all impeachments and the House has engaged in a valid impeachment and no one's really questioning whether or not the House's impeachment was a valid impeachment, then the trial seems quite straightforward from the constitutional text that the Senate continue the process, even if an officer has resigned or left office.
That's Keith Whittington, professor at Princeton University, member of the Federalist Society. So, Jack Beattie, there seems to be pretty close to consensus here, as Kate Shaw says, amongst anyone who's actually studied the Constitution, that this trial is constitutional. So it seems as if it's that argument being made by Donald Trump's lawyers kind of amounts to a distraction.
Yes. And, you know, the usual case on questions of constitutionality, what did John Marshall say? The court says what the law is. But not in this case. In a 1993 decision, unanimous decision, the court held that Senate impeachment trials and questions of constitutionality about them are, quote, non-justiciable. Quite a mouthful. Meaning, we don't deal with that at all. And Justice Rehnquist said that they are non-justiciable when there is, quote, a constitutional commitment of the issue to a coordinate political department, meaning the Constitution assigns this to the Congress, assigns the trial to the Senate, and there is no judicial review of it at all or judicial say in it. So we don't go to the court here to say what the law is. Practice says what the law is. The history says what the law is. Effectively, the impeachers say what the law is.
Well, Lisa Desjardins, we've got a minute here before our next break, but on that note of practice, if I understand this correctly, Chief Justice John Roberts is not presiding over this trial. I mean, he did the last one, so what's going on there?
That's correct. The Chief Justice is to preside over trials of current presidents in office. But now the understanding here is that when it's an official out of office or who is not the president, that it is the president pro tem of the Senate who is generally the one who will preside. And that is Patrick Leahy. And just to Kate points and Jack's point, you know, I'm not commenting on the constitutionality here, but in practice, absolutely. The way impeachment works is Congress says what impeachment is and Congress decides how it works. And it's a political process as well as a judicial one. But Congress controls all of that. They can make the process what they want.
Kate Shaw, giving you 15 seconds here, but Donald Trump's legal team says it's not fair that a Democratic senator is going to be presiding over this trial. Your thoughts?
You know, it would either be the vice president or the president pro tem of the Senate. I can't imagine former President Trump being happy with either of them. But it's really a pretty ministerial function, the presiding officer. The substance is going to have very little to do with who is presiding, and the substance is what's going to matter.
Okay, so we're going to talk more about the substance of the actual charge against Donald Trump when we come back. So Kate Shaw, Lisa Desjardins, and Jack Beattie, stand by. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmanning, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are talking about tomorrow's historic second impeachment trial of Donald Trump. It begins in the Senate tomorrow. I'm joined today by Jack Beattie. He's On Point's news analyst. Lisa Desjardins is also with us. She covers Congress for PBS NewsHour. And Kate Shaw is with us as well. She's a professor of law at Cardozo School of Law, co-host of the Strict Scrutiny podcast. So I want to talk in more detail with all of you about the actual charge against Donald Trump, that he incited the insurrectionist mob that invaded and attacked the Capitol and Congress on January 6th. Now, we know that Donald Trump's legal team is going to argue that he did not incite that mob. But in their trial memorandum, House managers look at several different moments of former President Trump's speeches, and they say that amounts to incitement. For example, there's this moment from a speech Trump gave on the very morning at that rally of January 6th.
We're going to walk down anyone you want, but I think right here we're going to walk down to the Capitol. And we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women. And we're probably not going to be cheering so much for some of them. Because you'll never take back our country with weakness. You have to show strength and you have to be strong.
Kate Shaw, Lisa Desjardins made the important point earlier that this is not a criminal trial, right? It is a political trial. So how do you define insurrectionist incitement in a political trial?
Well, you know, Congress will be able to define that, I think, term for itself. I mean, I think as a general matter, that clip that you played is one that is referenced several times in the trial brief. The brief describes President Trump as having whipped the crowd into a frenzy, you know, pointing then like a loaded cannon, the crowd that is, at the Capitol. And so I think that that speech and some earlier remarks by the president, either in person or on Twitter, right, come to D.C. on January 6th, will be wild, is another tweet of the president of President Trump's that is cited in the trial brief. So, you know, they're making an argument that the president was, you know, responsible for the violence that ensued at the Capitol on January 6th. Now, look, if you were trying to make the case in a criminal context, in a criminal trial, you know, incitement of violence of this sort, you would need to establish that the president's speech was intended to cause and likely to cause imminent lawless action here, right? The violence, the attack on the Capitol, all of that. But as we have said repeatedly now throughout the hour, the specific standards that would apply in a criminal trial aren't binding on the Senate. It doesn't need to use the precise standards, the precise test that a court would use. And yet I think all of that will inform, as it has in previous impeachments, how the Senate understands, you know, what the case that the managers are making will need to show in order to, you know, successfully establish that the president has committed high crimes and misdemeanors, here specifically incitement of insurrection, and warrants conviction and potential disqualification.
So, again, fact check me on something here, Professor Shaw. Was Andrew Johnson convicted?
No, he was acquitted by one vote.
So we've never actually had a conviction of
Correct.
An impeached president. So
nope.
Is it an impossible standard then?
You know, it's a very high standard by design, right? Two-thirds is a difficult, you know, supermajority in any, you know, political moment is very difficult to obtain. And I think particularly in this divided political moment, you know, Richard Nixon is sort of viewed as the exception that proves, you know, he resigned, of course, rather than departing upon conviction. But it's pretty broadly viewed as, you know, near certain that he would have been convicted had he actually been tried in the Senate. And then in part, he resigned with that understanding against that backdrop. So I'm not sure it's impossible. I just think that, you know, presidents have understood when they were facing near certain conviction that resignation was a more favorable kind of exit route. And, you know, there are lots of questions about whether there were some impropriety, vote trading, potentially even bribery in the Andrew Johnson trial itself. You know, again, the managers got within one vote of a conviction. So it has, you know, there have been, Bill Clinton was acquitted, you know, much more decisively. So I think it's a high standard by design. I don't think it's an impossible standard, although I think that, you know, it certainly seems to be the case going into this week that it is very unlikely that the House managers will reach two-thirds and get a conviction for President Trump.
Jack, your thoughts?
Well, you know, it's going to be awkward, to say the least, for the senators who vote to acquit Trump when the trial of the rioters begins, because we're told in the Washington Post this morning that the public defenders, who in many cases are taking their cases, that their defense is going to be the president called us to do it. We're following the president's, you know, instructions. And indeed, we've all seen the clips of, you know, rioters in the corridors of the Capitol saying, hey, I'm here because the boss said I should be here. It sounds like they're saying we were incited to do this by the president.
Mm. Well, so Lisa Desjardins, that brings us to a really interesting question from an On Point listener who says, are Republicans reluctant to convict/impeach Trump? Because if they do, they would have to acknowledge the role that some Republican senators, namely Hawley and Cruz and others, the role they played in helping spread election falsehoods.
That is a very insightful question. And that is its own probably discussion, because I think that what happens often in the U.S. Senate and in the House is that politicians are able to bifurcate their own responsibility and separate that from their political motivations, when in reality, the two are woven together. But they generally like to think that they're doing the right thing for the right reasons. However, we know that what they end up doing, the right thing for the right reasons as they think it, ends up being the politically convenient thing as well for themselves. So what's driving that is a tricky discussion, but I think it's a really good point to raise. And it's impossible to imagine a world where that's not on U.S. senators' minds. One other thing I want to raise just about the president's speech that I think we'll be hearing about from Republicans. You played that clip that was so important and is such a key part of the Democrats' argument. But, you know, Republicans, I think, are right to point out that the president also did say in that same speech that the protesters, he said, "I know you will be marching over to the Capitol to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard." And I think in a fair trial, both of those statements need to be looked at. Now, does, you know, saying something about being peaceful, does that override a different statement you make that is not perhaps peaceful? I don't know, but he did make both of those statements in that speech. I'm not making a case either way, but just to say what we will probably be hearing in the trial is both of those statements.
Interesting. Well, Kate Shaw, let me just hear from you quickly then. Not to reduce an impeachment trial down to the battle of sound bites here, but I think Lisa's making an important point that you know, in terms of deciding what constitutes incitement, what has more weight?
Well, you know, here I think it's important actually to broaden the lens a little bit beyond just January 6th. And I think the manager's brief really does this, right? Sort of basically offers a narrative that begins late on the night of January 3rd and is essentially this sustained campaign by the president to delegitimize his election loss and Joe Biden's election victory.
I mean, November 3rd, right?
Yes, November 3rd, sorry. So beginning on November 3rd and basically in the entire period between the election and January 6th, a sustained campaign to delegitimize the outcome of the election, and that this sort of the January 6th speech is sort of needs to be understood in the context of that broader effort. And I think that's a story that the managers will be telling. They tell in their brief, and they will certainly be telling in this trial.
Well, I mean, in fact, the House managers say that former President Trump's continuous lofting and amplification of total falsehoods about voter fraud, they say, quote, lay the groundwork for a refusal to accept any outcome other than his own continued grip on power. And they point to, for example, a speech that Trump gave on December 2nd and that contains those falsehoods. And here that is.
Millions of votes were cast illegally in the swing states alone. And if that's the case, the results of the individual swing states must be overturned and overturned immediately. Some people say that's too far out. That's too harsh. Well, does that mean we take a president and we've just elected a president where the votes were fraudulent? No, it means you have to turn over the election.
Donald Trump on December 2nd. You know, knowing what happened subsequently on January 6th, it is quite shocking, I have to say, to hear Donald Trump having said that. But Kate, let me ask you, you know, that we had that listener ask about Republican senatorial complicity in advancing that big lie here. I'm wondering what you think about that, because we're talking about the very same senators who are now jurors in this trial.
Yeah, you know, and I think that probably the reason you are going to see so much focus from the president's team and his defenders on this jurisdictional question that we were talking about, the timing question, is to avoid or to try to deflect the sort of focus from, you know, the president's conduct, again, leading up to and on January 6th, and the conduct of others around him who, you know, promoted and advanced this baseless narrative that there had been widespread election fraud. And that, of course, on the very day in which these events occurred, you know, Congress was in the process of counting and finalizing Joe Biden's victory. And, you know, arguably I think that pretty clearly there is some connection, the you know, between what happened at the Capitol, you know, the storming of the Capitol and some of the efforts inside the Capitol by members of Congress, right, to delay final certification of the votes, to deny the legitimacy of the votes from states that had voted for Joe Biden. I mean, you know, one thing we haven't talked about is there are a lot of, I think, open questions about the president's conduct during the hours in which the Capitol was under siege. And I would imagine the managers will spend some time focusing on that. There are allegations in their brief, just from press reports, about the president's, you know, delay in actually authorizing additional assistance, about his having continued to make phone calls to senators, urging them to try to further delay the final vote count, as opposed to attempting to, you know, check on their safety or assist in, you know, quelling these riots. And so, you know, all of that, I think, will be an important focus potentially of the trial, too. There's a lot we don't know about what happened on January 6th itself.
Lisa, I don't know if you can answer this question as a reporter, so totally okay if you need to take a pass at it. But is there also the sense that there's the legacy of the Senate that's on trial as well? Because, I mean, the very chamber in which this is happening got invaded. It got attacked. That's incontrovertible. And so there is this sort of national question that if this doesn't constitute some kind of true offense against the body of the democracy of the United States, what does? I mean, I just wonder if the senators think to themselves, you know, it is our very chamber that's also, in a sense, its legacy that hangs in the balance.
That is a fascinating question. And I have to convey my bias, which is I spend so much time at the Capitol that I might have too much of a Capitol Hill mindset about this. I think that's a question over how history judges this versus how it's being judged by the Senate itself right now. I don't think the Senate sees it that way. I think that if you look, for example, at the Andrew Johnson trial, that was a trial about corruption, direction of the country. We're not the only trial that we saw for an impeached official about corruption. But yet, when we look back in history, we look at the person who was being impeached. We don't seem to be judging government as a whole. And I think that's the feeling about this trial in the Senate right now. Now, I don't know how history will judge it, but I have that sort of context in my head to help convey how I think people in the Senate look at it now. Yeah. This is about President Trump, not about the Senate from their point of view.
Jack, your thoughts on that?
And the senators are going to have to contend with the you know, inspiring stand of, what is it, 10 or 11 Republicans led by Lynn Cheney, who voted to in the House, who voted to impeach the president. And all of them now are facing, you know, repercussions. And they have done the right thing for the country. And Trump is essentially saying, we're going to run people against you in the primaries and get you out. The senators see that. So it's really a question of what did John F. Kennedy, title of his book, Profiles in Courage. I don't think we're going to see many of those from the senators. We saw it from Lynn Cheney and her colleagues.
Well, sort of the last area of exploration in the 2 minutes that we have left, I'm going to swing back to where we started with Jack talking about what is accountability in the eyes of history, at least? And Jack, we got some comments here from listeners. Norman Jefferson says, I don't think Trump cares much about being impeached twice because he can blame it on Democrats. The problem is the GOP has refused to give him tangible consequences. There will be emboldened future presidents. Matt Godwin says, I have to disagree that Trump has already been held accountable. While deserved, the first impeachment was strictly along party lines, which leaves the door open for criticism of its validity. Conviction is the only way to hold him unquestionably accountable now. So, Kate Shaw, you're going to get the last swing at this here. What do you think accountability is or should look like in this circumstance, at this, I don't know, almost like pivot point for American democracy?
Now, I think Jack was right at the outset when he said that, you know, sort of the meaning of this impeachment trial will not turn on whether there's a conviction or an acquittal at the end of it, right? So whether presidential conduct like this is sort of adjudged as out of bounds might be possible to sort of establish in the court of public opinion whether or not there is a conviction. So Andrew Johnson, you know, didn't run for president again in 1868 after he was acquitted, and in some ways has represented an example of the kinds of conduct and rhetoric that presidents have avoided essentially ever since. And so President Trump, I think, could well be condemned in history and in the court of public opinion, even if he is acquitted, as seems very likely to be the case. So to me, all of those things matter from the perspective of accountability.
Well, Kate Shaw is a law professor at Cardozo School of Law and co-host of the Strict Scrutiny podcast. Professor Shaw, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Lisa Desjardins with PBS NewsHour. Lisa, thank you, as always, for being with us.
You're welcome.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Jack, it was great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.